Well, good morning, everyone. Good to see so many of you here. Before I share some of my ideas with you, I just wanted to say what a pleasure and a privilege it is to have had this invitation from the organisers, and I thank them for that. I feel very much, I must say, that I'm a disciplinary visitor here with you amongst so many clinicians. So I feel that I'm a friendly stranger with some shared interests with you. Now, before I begin, I think it's relevant to say that this presentation comes with a health warning, because you're not going to get any answers to anything, and you're going to get a few more questions, and I hope, of course, some probing and questioning information drawn mainly, I would say, from the discipline of medical sociology, which is my primary background, but also a little bit from anthropology that I've been engaging with recently, and increasingly it's that discipline that started to inform some of my work. So let's see what you make of it. The title of the presentation involves the concept of role models. And we think about role models in different ways, but at an individual level, within health and medicine, we've been exposed in the literature and in different settings of clinical practice to different kinds of role models. The caring nurse. You'll forgive me for saying this, but with my gender background, the caring nurse is usually a woman. Increasingly, though, we're seeing more men enter nurse training. We have the role model of the expert physician, who has diagnostic expertise, and hopefully for many people who are unwell, solutions to their health problems. We have the skilled surgeon as a role model, don't we? Often now aided by very sophisticated technological regimes, instrumentation. I've just finished writing about that in a book of mine that's coming out later this year. And with a little bit of nostalgia, what about the efficient matron? Now, the efficient matron, you can hear me nearly laughing here, is really a disappearing phenomenon. Because the way that in the UK, for example, nursing is organised, we're much more seeing the presence of a matron more as a manager and supervisor, and sometimes I think with less hands-on care. Role models don't just concern individuals in professional practice. We also now have a plethora of organisational role models. We have those across business, but within health and medicine, we look towards particular organisational role models that increasingly are focused on efficiency measurements. So, a range of clinical settings now become role models in themselves. So hospitals and hospices and the care home provide a mix of provision for those who are approaching the end of life. As far as death and dying are concerned, hospitals are not ideal settings, as death in that particular context runs counter to the cure narrative, which is the root of the hospital's imperative. But hospices also do not have the monopoly, I would argue, on enabling people to die well. But hospices as a particular form of health organisation has received almost, I would argue, universal social approval. And death in hospice has come to be seen as a role model of good practice. So where does spirituality fit within those different clinical contexts in relation to dying people? We've heard so much already about spirituality, about its meaning, how thinking about spirituality is deeply personal, applied spirituality is relevant. So some of this will already be familiar to you. The contested nature of spirituality, it's subjective, it's highly personal, and on a conceptual level, I think we can all agree that it's pluralistic. The philosophy of palliative care that focuses on physical, psychological, practical and spiritual needs of dying people is the foundation of hospice care, and increasingly holistic care is seen as the badge of hospice. And of course, as we've been reminded already, spiritual care has long been a component of nursing, though in the literature this is often recounted in problematic terms. So Carr, for example, talks about the conceptual confusion that sometimes surrounds spiritual care in the context of nursing. And Burkett and Hogan discussed the difficulties of assessing spiritual care in nursing practice. So this seems to suggest that issues around spirituality raise sometimes difficult practical concerns for clinicians. I'm not arguing that's always the case, but there's so much literature that supports this area as being one that's difficult to implement. It would be disingenuous of me at this stage not to acknowledge that. Well, meanings of spirituality. I think we must all be soaked up in this already, so I'll be fairly brief about this. Key dimensions of spirituality is different from religion. It's been highlighted by Bruce Rumbold. Feature of personhood, meaning and value in life, connected to religious belief. But I did like what Will McSherry had to say, that spirituality can be whatever we want it to be, but it is always culturally and socially shaped. And I really like Vivat's definition when she says that what remains of the self is spirituality when material things drop away. Traditional understandings of spirituality generally connect, though, to a system of religious belief. But there is an increasing discussion in the literature of a much more diverse taxonomy. And I wanted here just to reflect that diversity as a starting point. I really like Vivat's offering to us that what remains of the self when material things drop away is spirituality. I was doing a practice visit recently at a hospice in southern England, and I was sitting with a young man who had terminal lung cancer, and What he told me, that his essence was centred on Arsenal Football Club. And he was talking about his annual season ticket and how his life was organised around being able to go to the football, home matches, away matches. And what disturbed him most was being disconnected from his beloved Arsenal. And by the bed was the Arsenal football shirt, and he'd actually got a signed football from the team. And this was deeply treasured. I found it very difficult to connect with that because I'm not really a football person. But his great sense of allegiance and connectedness to this aspect of his life, as I came away, I thought, you know what? That's his spirit there. That's his essence. That's what means so much to him. And that was about all he talked about. So spiritual care. We've already heard quite a lot about this as well, haven't we? Spiritual care of dying people is widely debated in the literature, and as you might expect, it receives a lot of attention in the palliative care literature. I've just drawn a few statements about spiritual care for you to consider. Person-centred attention. We thought about that yesterday, didn't we? Giving time and listening. I love this one by Jenny Hockey. Now, she's a medical sociologist from the University of Sheffield. She thinks about spiritual care in terms of acknowledging how we have become in a non-judgmental way and helping someone to understand themselves. Now, in terms of palliative care philosophy, the unit of care is the family. And in general, I think it would be fair to say that the concept of the family in this context is not often problematized or theorized. But Randall and Downey discuss the fact that palliative care considers the unit of the family as the unit of care as potentially problematic. I don't know I've been fully persuaded by that until, in a study of mine about social work practice within palliative care, I did come across examples where palliative care patients actually needed protection from their families. There were different kinds of problems, and in two cases in particular, the family was at war over the dying person. And that helped me think again about Randall and Downey's proposition. So I do think that prioritising the unit of care as the family just may raise questions about the sustainability of this model of care. The place of spirituality within palliative care is well established, and as I've explained, that extends to the dying person's family and friends. And the role model of holistic care as part of palliative care practice, I think, needs further inquiry. We need to explore that further. We've also heard already about the very stretched nature of much health care provision around efficiency, targets, poor resources, not enough staffing. And given the intensely personal and relational nature of spiritual care, not just of dying people, but all people in healthcare settings, I do wonder whether it's reasonable to expect that this is a part of the role of health professionals in terms of their expectations. Spiritual care takes time. I would argue it needs continuity. And someone yesterday did even say, as I would say, is this in fact fast, in reality, becoming a luxury within modern healthcare? special care of dying people, I mean a relational model of care. When I think about this model, it's about enabling the person to be put back together again in their full context. The experience of illness, different treatment regimes, lives changed by visits to clinicians, often having to experience other kinds of losses, loss of capacity, loss of job, loss of the whole person as citizen in their daily life through serious illness, I think does beg the question of what kind of spiritual care is really useful. And again, it does beg the question, I mean, is spiritual care by healthcare professionals appropriate or realistic? The temporal and emotional dimensions of spiritual caregiving emerged in my own research, and I note a quote here from a man, a participant in the study. Maury is the man speaking on this slide, and he told me just how much he valued the physical care of the palliative care team, the way they managed his symptoms. They arranged for different kinds of alternative treatment for him, and this was in a teaching hospital setting, not in a hospice, and he told me how much he enjoyed the reflexology. But one day when I was there, he said, they keep asking me these questions about my history, about my background. He said, I can't tell them, Jackie. I just can't tell them. I haven't got the energy. And what he told me, he said he experienced these questions that he called probing as an intrusion and almost as an harassment. And on this particular day, he said, what I really need is protection from their questions. And I found that obviously deeply moving. And he said, it is your job to go and explain that to them. Imagine how that went down, can't you? Anyway, I did attempt to do that, and when I went again to see him, he said, it's so much better. He said, they don't ask me any of those things anymore. I thought, you know what? That's a result. For Maury, that was a result, wasn't it? Now we get to the contentious bit. Alternative approaches. Hands up anyone here who's come across the work of Alan Kelleher. Oh, that's a start. That's a start. Good. Alan Kelleher is an Australian sociologist who has been researching and writing about the social context of death and dying and its various components for many years. And he's developed what he would describe as a public health model that includes spiritual care of dying people. He particularly supports capacity building of communities and families and individuals, not in a professional way, but in as part of a lay model, about developing confidence in issues surrounding death and dying and being able to reclaim the capacity to give spiritual care as a lay capacity that is distinct from that work often done, as we have seen, by healthcare professionals. Now, I'm also going to be talking to you about death doulas, and this is another emerging area. I've not read an awful lot about that, but I'm going to talk to you about what I've come across. So how are we doing? We're okay. Kelleher's extensive work, I thought it was worthwhile just to look in a bit more detail at his model. So the key elements are development of non-professional social caring capital, involves friends and family, involves honouring individual and community legacies with reflecting back processes, reminding and remembering, and a key component actually of his model is reciprocity. And he argues for a relational and reciprocal model between dying people and caregivers. Now, his really is what I call, I don't think he calls it that, but I call it a citizenship model. Because in terms of connectivity and continuity, something that Kelleher argues very strongly is that being fully known in context is so important, particularly at the end of life. And he suggests that clinicians, as newcomers, often, not always, but often as newcomers to that person's life, they will have only a limited opportunity to give meaningful support. I keep wanting to go back to the practical elements of this model. How would it work? What about people who don't have connections in their community, who don't have supportive family and friends? And going back to this example I experienced when I was exploring social work practice in palliative care, you know, people who find themselves in the middle of families at war, doesn't seem great, does it, as a possibility for enactment of this model. Another strand or alternative is death awareness. Now, introduction of death education as a mandatory part of the school curriculum. Now, this is not occurring at present, but there's no doubt this is gradually coming higher up the agenda, so that children probably in older primary school age and certainly in secondary school, as part of social and personal education, would be given an opportunity to explore death and dying as part of a life narrative. That's something that's gradually coming to the fore as a possibility. Kelleher also thinks that young people perhaps need the opportunities to volunteer in contexts connected to death, hospices, funeral companies and daycare centres. And the friend of one of my daughters, she volunteered in a local funeral company, and she reported that it just changed her whole mind about this, and she decided that she was going to actually apply to do the foundation degree in funeral studies as a result. And I thought that was quite a compelling and not life-changing necessarily, but a really interesting change of pathway for that young person. So death doulas. Anyone heard of death doulas? Oh, good. Not much written about this yet, but key characteristics of death doulas is that they parallel the work of birth doulas. A friend at the end, the feature of open and honest communication about death. Some have a spiritual approach, but not all. End-of-life companionship as a service and invited in. Very much a communitarian model of death as the natural conclusion to life. I came across this recently, as you will see, just a couple of weeks ago. This is a commentary from a death doula called Rebecca Green, There was a lot more that she's explained about the role that I could have included. But given the focus of this conference and the slot I'd been given, I just wanted to include for you what she says about spirituality. Some people will hate me for this, but so be it. If a person has not found spirituality to be useful to them before they become ill, why introduce it when a person is facing death? I feel it's a way of avoiding the living person in front of you and avoiding yourself. Providing a solution to this problem of death with a story, it's big business, this spirituality. It preys on the vulnerable, and it's a crutch that's going to break when you lean on it. You have your life, your living moments, and yourself, right up to the very end. You are enough. You don't need to be spiritual. I wonder what you think about that. Interesting, isn't it? I think one, perhaps, aspect that this particular death doula may not have grasped is that, in fact, spirituality can be disconnected from religion and covers a plethora of essences, if you like. So I think she maybe had not got to grips with the wide concept of spirituality, but this quote from her was published in the Guardian newspaper, which is a great UK newspaper that I take, just recently, as part of a wider article about death and dying and the role of death doulas as caregivers and spiritual supporters. So I thought relevant for us today. So where does this leave us? We know that spiritual care can be complex, and it's always shaped by context. Shared across domains of practice, ministers of religion and healthcare workers, and in the lay community as well, involving family, friends, neighbours, and dedicated death companions. That's how I describe a death doula. But it always has the feature of connectivity. That was a brief presentation, and it was intentionally so, because I'm hoping that we're now going to have some interesting questions and a debate about where you think these alternative approaches might fit alongside the more conventional approaches to spiritual care, particularly in clinical contexts as well as in social care contexts. So I'm looking forward to your questions.
Jackie, thank you for that wonderful presentation and so much food for thought. I have heard of death doulas just as a, you know, maybe a more in America, the hospice volunteer is a huge positive component for people dying. And there are other that are not hospice models, but they use it in hospitals in general, which are companions for the dying. There are many programs called companions, which I think is probably similar to what you're calling death doulas. And I think expanding our, the team approach, that the team approach can include volunteers. Mm-hmm. And volunteers can make a huge difference. There's a colleague of mine, Eric Lindner, wrote a book. He's a lawyer, actually, who decided to become a hospice volunteer, and it's called Hospice Voices. And it's a very profound sharing of his journey with people. One of the things, though, I think is really important, and I'd be curious for you to comment, maybe I'm not sure that everybody knows, the training that's involved for people. Because I think volunteers, certainly it's going to have an impact on them. They have to have, in the same way that, you know, we talked about clinicians, they have to have some kind of grounding to be able to do this. And also understanding what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, where, you know, what to do. So I would love to hear your comments more about some of the training that deaf doulas have. And I'm not sure these, I wouldn't call these alternative models. I think they should be integrated. I think they're wonderful, but I'd love to hear more from you about the training.
I felt bound to characterize these models as alternative because I suppose I felt a bit alternative amongst so many clinicians. So that was my starting point. In terms of volunteers in hospices, there are a whole range of models that include volunteers as members of the disciplinary team, but also volunteers that have very clearly demarcated roles. This is the case often in the UK. So they would be working as bereavement counsellors, they might be working in the coffee shop, they might be delivering alternative therapies, complementary therapies, they also might be working as drivers and as gardeners. And there's a whole range of training that would be appropriate. The other side of the coin, of course, is the kind of support that volunteers are given and also their information needs. Now, the narrative that I've read about deaf doulas is that this is very much more full on. So it isn't clearly demarcated and it is very much an invited in role. So the dying person invites the death doula in, and together there is almost a life sharing and a life shaping companionship. And that to me suggests a rather a different level of giving than a hospice volunteer who may be much more boundaried, not least because of the hospice organisation rules and, if you like, terms of operation. My understanding is that being a death doula is quite a full-on activity. And reading more about what Rebecca Green had to say in the article, I mean, she's had, I think she said, 5 years' experience now as a death doula. And for her, this is a life undertaking. And so I suppose that removes it slightly from the context of prescribed volunteer tasks. Thank you.
Well, I think you're from Austria. I'm in internal medicine. You brought up this a line where you wrote, putting the dying person back together again in their full context. And you brought this example up of this guy who just wanted to be left alone with his history and what it is. I was wondering what the patient, the person himself, really wants, because I differentiate between a felt need and a real need. As a physician, when a patient comes to me and he has a disease, I instantly in my mind I have the things which I think he needs to get a cure or at least to get will be able to go on in a good way. But very often people have a different understanding what quality of life means for them. So it boils down to values of the patient and values of mine as a treater of the patient, and also what is my intention, I guess, because as a physician, for example, if somebody has an infectious disease, I want to cure it. Yeah? All of us have contracted a deadly disease, which is eternal death. This is from a Christian viewpoint now. Mm. And I also, we have a cure, and it's written in the Bible, and this is what I long in my heart that a person may understand. But this is not what a patient often has as a felt need. A felt need is often in a completely different way. So really thank you for bringing this up, what this point, what the patient really wants. But I think For me, there is a large tension in it.
Yeah.
What the patient feels and knows at the very moment, what we think, what would be best for him, what not always is best for him, and how we should continue from here to there. Thank you.
Can I just say that in the example that I chose, this particular man was receiving the most fantastic support from one or two members of his family and a long, long-standing friend. And I think he thought that was enough. Now, he was a Jewish man. And one of the things he also said to me was, on no account, Jackie, must the rabbi come. Don't want to see the rabbi. Now, you make sure that he doesn't come. I said, okay. So I felt that in this example, his spiritual needs, I think, were met. But it is important that you discriminate, actually, between almost the spoken need and the deeply felt need. And maybe there's a difference. And some things are unsayable. So I perhaps should have pointed that out about Maury. He was well served and he was ready, you know, he was absolutely ready. But of course his situation might have been very different. And then there may have been different outcomes in terms of the efforts of the palliative care team. Thank you.
Martin Walton from the Netherlands, thank you very much also for your provocative quotations that you provide us. If I could turn into that last quotation from Rebecca Green.
Yeah.
Does that might tie into what you were just saying about spoken and unspoken needs? Because doesn't it make a difference about how we speak of them? And I noticed she sort of put spirituality between quotation marks.
That's because it was like that in the newspaper.
Right. Okay, but that's fine. But, I mean, if it had been... if you look at the end of the quote and were to call that existential needs, you know, something very different would happen with the quote. So I'm wondering, is the problem, the issues that we're dealing with, or is the problem that spirituality is getting, the term spirituality is getting in the way at times? I'm wondering how you read her commentary.
I read that comment in the context of thinking that this death doula, Rebecca Green, maybe had limited opportunity to explore the different meanings of the concept of spirituality, and that it is highly plural, deeply personal, because if spirituality is a person's essence, then we've all got it. Whether we see it as something that's tangible and absolutely essential is another matter. So for me, I read that as a, I must say, as an academic, I felt that this particular quotation was evidence of a lack of perhaps deep understanding on the part of this death doula. That's how I saw it.
Jackie, Christopher DeBono from Toronto, Canada. Hello. Thank you, first of all, for your presentation. Ditto on the provocative nature of your questions. And I want to just push your familiarity with Kelleher a little further,
right,
if you might, for commentary. And it's this interest in terms of the lay capacity and meeting needs, spoken or unspoken, of our patients. So I have two thoughts. One is with the patient that you've described that didn't want to see that care offered. If you could comment a little bit on what might be an invasive approach to somebody's inner life or core versus an accompaniment of where they are, and whether Kelleher offers some parameters or guidelines on that. And as you talk more about the doula, I wondered if that isn't another metaphor for what we're trying to do. And I just wondered where else you would go with that.
Okay, second part first. I think what I've understood about death doulas is that actually it's It refers to a particular kind of companionship model that is a lay model outside of clinical frameworks. That's how I understand it. And the way that it seems to work is through almost connectivity and knowing. So the history of this particular death doula and her work is recounted through, if you like, connections. So she accompanied this person that she knew through the family of someone else. It was through known networks. So it appeared that there's no kind of, if you like, advertising or sale of a service. Right, so just wanted to say that. And I do think it is a distinctly different model. I think it's still emerging. Okay. So I think we have to rest with its distinctiveness. Now, the first part of the question about Alan Kelleher and his ideas, you asked about the extent to which the spiritual questioning is an intrusion. Is that what you said?
I was using, just because you've introduced his framework in terms of, of lay capacity, and then with the model about a very invasive approach that you had to sort of withdraw, I'm wondering whether he has any, or she has any examples on understanding what the accompaniment might be. Because even with the distinction you're making right now between clinical and non-clinical, one of my background questions would be, how do we integrate that in a full service when people come into hospice care or palliative care?
Well, Kelleher distinguishes between physical care and spiritual care. There's no doubt about it. So strong advocate of good symptom management, pain relief, and so on. But he is advocating for a return to what he sees as traditional models of care, which are centered on families and communities. Now, this model, in fact, has been trialed in southern India, in Kerala, with Suresh Kumar. Now, a lot has been written about this. And actually, the spiritual care of dying people is now, within this model and this area, has been devolved entirely to the community. So these are neighbours, friends, not always family, who are giving spiritual nourishment and support in different ways to dying people. And the way that this is framed in Kelleher's model is a move towards what he describes as compassionate cities. I mean, this is a huge public health model that he's outlining, and it's got all different strands. And I'd be here till tomorrow if I outlined all of that for you. So what we're actually seeing is some practical examples of this. And a colleague of mine from the university visited Kerala to try and get a sense of what is going on there and how it's working. And, of course, what one has to realise in that context is that clinicians of all kinds are scarce on the ground. So, in a way, this model of Kelleher's is responding to a particular need in that context. And that may not be the same in other contexts.
Karen Joris from Freiburg. I'd like to ask a question also sort of going in the same direction. Wondering how are the death doulas integrated into perhaps the palliative care setting or into the clinical setting, because palliative care focuses on actually not only the patient, but their whole system, the whole unit of care, and the family. And so I think if this doula is an important person for the patient, it would be interesting for me how they're integrated into the care.
Well, there's been very little written about this, and it's difficult for me to answer this. I understand from this particular example that the doula is there alongside the dying person and is also supporting them in terms of the clinical interventions that are still taking place. But the detail of that, I'm not able to answer that. One thing I would say with this example, this particular woman had been working in palliative care. Now, she didn't say, yes, she was a nurse. She'd been working as a palliative care nurse in a hospice. That's what the article said. And she said she felt that the opportunity in that context to be fully available and present for the dying person was limited organisationally. There were some other things that she reported as well, which I think may be individual and personal to this example. She says that the hospice is too fluffy and is not really facing death. And she said it's avoiding the truth for some people. Thought that was really interesting. So she had left the employment of the hospice and was working in a different way. I mean, we mustn't place too much emphasis on one example. But I think that's interesting in itself. You can get this online, this article. It's marvellous. In fact, I've probably got a copy here, if anyone wants to see it.
I'm Michael O'Sullivan from Ireland. I work with postgraduate students in the field of spirituality studies, but I'm also a Jesuit priest. And some years ago, when I was in another country, a woman came to speak with me about what you could say was her ministry. And I hadn't heard of it before, and it was to accompany people in their funeral who had no one to accompany them. They would die and the undertaker would contact her, and she would simply walk behind the hearse and to the graveyard to honour that person who had no one else to be with them. And you were speaking there about families and communities and involving citizens and so on. That was the most extreme, and it wasn't a person obviously ill or dying but actually dead, and that the whole aspect of caring for the person extending on into their death when they were completely alone and no one else to be with them. And that's what she was dedicating herself to doing, to be a companion to the dead in their funerals when they had no one else to be with them.
Thank you. I don't think I've come across that as an example. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Just a short and an overall question. When you have young people, young students, who have a life still ahead of us, ahead of them, Well, I'm sorry, I'm in my mid-70s and I still believe that I have my life still ahead of myself. But anyway, when you introduce young students who, in a way, should have the feeling that their life is still ahead of them, when you introduce them to the issues of death and dying, does that increase the possibility of them becoming suicidal? Thank you.
Am I equipped to answer that? No, I don't think I am. But can I just say, there's quite a lot of literature written about death and dying education for quite young children. There's a charity in the UK called Winston's Wish, which supports bereaved children, often very young children. And some of their work suggests that storytelling, if you like, around death and dying for very young children is often important and effective in helping them adapt to losses. And some of the earliest losses are the losses of a pet. And this can be absolutely emotionally devastating for children and young people, as of course it can be for older people. But their work there, this charity in Cheltenham, in Gloucestershire, in England, they've done extensive work in this area, and I can't respond specifically to the issue of suicide, but they say that there is evidence that they have that this kind of integration of understanding of death and dying as part of life will support children in helping them adapt to losses and significant transitions.
If I may, to it's just you were saying that in Lucca you plan to do the training for the schools of social education about end of life, dying, and bereavement. And I want to say that in Poland we already adapted that. We have all schools being trained of end of life and volunteering, and there's no fear of suicidal. It's just the opposite. I think it's just something that we make ars moriendi. So it's just to be aware of death and dying as a part of life. And I think it produces both the interest of the students, awareness among the teachers, and it gives us a lot of volunteers. So I'll be talking about that in a moment. But just to
can I just say thank you all for your great questions and comments.